This is Judaism Unbound, episode 75, The Myth of Apolitical Judaism. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofus.
And we are here today with Lila Corwin Berman. She is professor of history at Temple University, where she holds the Murray Friedman Chair of American Jewish History and directs the Feinstein Center for American Jewish History. Lila Corwin Berman is the author of two books. One is called Speaking of Jews, Rabbis, Intellectuals, and the Creation of an American Public Identity, as well as Metropolitan Jews, Politics, Race, and Religion in Postwar Detroit. She's currently at work on a book called The American Jewish Philanthropic Complex, The Historical Formation of a Multi-Billion Dollar Institution. And we're very excited to speak with her today about the history of American Judaism and how the situation has gotten to where it is. So Lila, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's a great thrill to have you.
It's great to be here.
Well, I wanted to start a little bit, at least with sort of my understanding of your basic conception in your book, Speaking of Jews, and then to sort of jump off from there. But if I understand correctly, sort of your basic gist of what you're talking about in that book, in the 20th century, the Jewish community felt a strong need to explain itself to the larger American non-Jewish community, and that in that work to explain itself, it actually had an enormously powerful formative effect in the essentially the creation of what became 20th century American Judaism. And I'm wondering if you could just sort of elaborate on that or correct me if I'm wrong and just sort of also start to connect it to what you see happening in the 21st century.
The way you describe it really does, I think, encapsulate what my goals were in that book. I became really interested in the kind of public acts of defining and explaining Jewishness in the United States, specifically in the 1920s, once the bulk of Eastern European Jewish immigrants, there had been like a huge influx of them, you know, as you know, in the late 19th and early 20th century, that was then cut off in the 1920s with immigration restriction legislation. So you have now a population that doesn't have the same kind of influx of new people coming in. And so it's in a sense a more stable population. Working now to think about what does it mean to be in the United States and working therefore to kind of weave themselves into the political language, the cultural language, the economic language of being American. And so in the book, the real kind of historical arc that I found was that the shift, the most important shift really was in the embrace of social scientific language, that there was not really the vocabulary for explaining Jewishness as a social scientific category, of a category of something in between race and religion, something that we might think of as ethnicity today. That category was really gestating in the 1920s. And then I guess you were asking the extent to which this kind of enabled me to think about how American Jewish identity, American Judaism kind of emerges in the later part of the 20th century and into the 21st century. And I think that in many ways, the language that mid-century Jews developed served Jews very, very well for many decades, but came to butt up against several challenges as Jews mixed with non-Jewish populations, especially marrying non-Jews, the kind of inevitability that social scientific language had hinged upon, right? That, you know, that of course somebody would sort of maintain this identity by where they lived, by certain kinds of social patterns. Those start to unravel. And so there's sort of new crises of, you know, how do you explain that somebody is Jewish who's not fitting into some of those social scientific categories?
So just fleshing this out a little bit, I'm really interested on a number of levels. First off, when I read the book Speaking of Jews, one of the first things that became clear to me was like, oh, this the way I've like lived and spoken about Judaism, I thought was just how Judaism was. The idea that talking about the Jewish community or Jewish peoplehood, the idea that those are new, like totally blew my mind, because ultimately I've been so deep in that sociological understanding that I didn't even realize it was only one understanding. I thought it was just like the way that we do this. So I guess I'd love to hear a little bit more about like peoplehood and community, some of those words that come up to exemplify this sociological shift. part of that's because I met you at this Wrestling with Peoplehood conference that you helped to organize. But also because I think we have used these terms on our show and haven't totally wrestled with them in the ways that could be interesting.
Excellent. Yeah. You know, it's interesting because there's two books that I've read recently, and one of them is a book called Jew by Cynthia Baker, and it's about the word Jew. And the other is Peoplehood by Noam Pianco. And both of these books, which were written after Speaking of Jews, and so unfortunately I wasn't able to sort of integrate their analysis and arguments into my book, into that first book. Both of these books are really strong in doing the work of showing that the terminology of what it means, how, not even what it means to be Jewish, but simply the discourse, the language of Jewishness, both is very rooted in particular historical moments and times. And so, for example, peoplehood is really a term that cannot be traced beyond earlier than the 20th century. And even Jew as a self-designation, I am a Jew, is a fairly recent grammatical construction, as opposed to someone else designating, a non-Jew designating a Jew as a Jew. But at the same time, these are not just invented whole cloth, right? So there is, and I think this is actually, like, to me, one of the fascinating tensions of doing something called Jewish history, right? You're ultimately writing history, which is about change over time. It's not about something essential that is, about a group of people that holds on to a certain essentialism, right, of being eternal, of something unchanging. And so there's sort of like the tension written into, you know, what does it even mean to do the history of this kind of category? I think people who do history of religion likewise grapple with this. So all of this is to say that, you know, yes, I do stand by the book's conclusion that this social scientific language really is fundamentally tied to the historical context of the 20th century and of the United States and intellectual trends happening in the United States, having to do with grappling with the diversity of people and traditions and folkways coming together in this one place. And social scientific language was a very effective language of a particular kind of American democracy. But on the other hand, I think that Jews throughout history had been sort of grappling with, you know, how do they define themselves when they're generally, in most periods in their history, living under the rule of other groups of people, right? Who both want to define them in certain ways, who are ambivalent at best, and, you know, sometimes much worse about letting them be part of the mainstream. And so there, you know, there already was a lot of, you know, centuries and centuries of sort of grappling with how do you live in a host society that is going to define you in certain ways, and that you also, you know, have some of your own ways of defining yourself, right? So when you look, for example, in the late 18th and 19th century in places in Europe, as the Enlightenment is happening and there's more and more thinking about religion and separating religion from the state, you have a kind of efflorescence of Jews thinking about Judaism and thinking about defining themselves as a religious group, right? Which really wasn't how they had been defining themselves, you know, in earlier periods. So in the United States in the 20th century, when you have intellectually lots of different folks who are writing at universities, many of whom are in cities, trying to think about all of these different groups of people who are coming together, who, you know, the American state wants to be productive citizens in this capitalist kind of democracy, so who have to live together. And there's this sort of search for, you know, vocabulary to talk about all these groups and how they can be different and yet be involved in this same project. Social scientific language is an answer. It's not really about belief per se. It's not about the acts that one does of faith or pledging oneself to a certain kind of belief, right? It's sort of just about who one is, one's social context, who one marries, and then it becomes sort of tied into arguments about stability, which again is very much an interest of American democracy and effective capitalism.
You know, I think of a discussion that Lex and I have been having about the term religion, where, you know, Lex has an academic view of the term, and he explains that religion doesn't necessarily mean worshiping God and so such. But I feel like I have a kind of more, you know, layman sense of it. And I think that probably emerged out of this period that's, you know, religion is that category in America that has to do with worshiping God, where we live and let live about it. And so, you know, for me, who's not looking for a religion in that sense, you know, when Judaism's presented as a religion, that alienates me, you know, and so how do we, you know, in an environment where we don't have the same pressure of an immigration into a new society to help to force us to reshape our language, you know, are there other ways that you see this happening or that you could imagine it happening where we could really grapple with this more effectively than we seem to be?
It's hard because I have some misgivings about the project of, like, you know, let's find the new vocabulary, because too often you just end up with like ridiculous jargon. I'm now studying philanthropy and I see the really kind of absurdity with which certain words just become like freighted with all this meaning. And so it's used over and over and has a kind of emptiness. And so, you know, the project is someone like sort of sitting around and being like, okay, what word can we use for like millennials, or is it Generation Z, or, you know, there's something that would feel a little bit false about that. And so I think that the language is obviously crucial, and it's also proxy for some other work that has to happen. And I think part of that work is trying to think about, you know, what are the pieces of being Jewish today that people are finding meaningful, that people are finding substantive, and then to think about what are the sustainable terms to use to talk about those pieces.
I'd love to jump in a little bit more to an aspect you brought up earlier briefly, but basically, you know, the I word, we joke, the intermarriage question, because we've talked at various points on our show with various different guests about intermarriage, but the lens you bring is really interesting because you talk about how there are unique challenges that intermarriage presents to Judaism when you are looking at Judaism from this social scientific lens. And I'd love to hear more from you why it is that your book, which is, you know, as Dan mentioned, about how Jews present themselves to non-Jews and lots of stuff about different media, like, why does it culminate with this question of intermarriage in the late 20th and early 21st centuries?
At the crux of that social scientific language and of the studies of sort of what was maintaining Jewishness is this issue of Jews marrying Jews, right? And it had been turned into this kind of formula, in a sense, you know, that this was one place where that social scientific definition would really hold on tightly because people would marry within particular kinds of groups, right? And so the book that Will Herberg wrote in the 1950s, Protestant Catholic Jew, which has a title as if it's talking about religion, but really is not talking about religion. And he says as much, right? It's really not about people believing things. This is about these kinds of cultural patterns. Really, this is about what it means to be ethnic in a certain sense. And it's dividing upon these lines. And those lines are totally defined by marital patterns. And so at the same time, then, that Jews seem to have helped find this sort of answer of how to manage American diversity, you have Jews doing this thing that is really challenging to that and undermining to this kind of synthesis and this balance that they had put together. And you have Jews starting to say, I don't see any particular reason why I necessarily need to marry somebody who's also Jewish. And I believe I share values and I share ideals and would like to share a future and perhaps children with somebody who's not Jewish. And that's not making me think that this, you know, this marriage will not work out, that there's going to be this, you know, core issue that's going to make it impossible for us to build a union, which had sort of been the vocabulary before. And so that's why, to me, you know, intellectually, the puzzle of the book then ends with thinking about what happens when this language confronts intermarriage. You know, this language that has done a very good job explaining endogamy, explaining why Jews should marry Jews, How's it going to explain why Jews are marrying non-Jews? And you know, what kinds of acrobatics you're going to have to do to make sense of that? And so some of it is just pure censoriousness. This is bad, bad, bad. Needs to stop. Some of it is talking about ways that the Jewish group can sort of absorb others and turn them into Jews, and what would that look like? The language of social science is not very good for explaining that that's possible. And then there's just a lot of confusion. And I think some of the intermarriage crisis that people start to talk about as early as the 60s, you know, but more and more in the 70s and 80s, is exactly that sort of failure of language to understand this.
Perhaps it is true in a certain case, right, that the way the Judaism, as you are describing, and not you, but the person who's concerned about intermarriage, the Judaism that as you're describing it, perhaps can't survive intermarriage intact. And maybe it can. That's question number one. And question number two is, if it can't, maybe your definition of Judaism was wrong, right? And maybe all of our definition of Judaism was wrong, right? And that intermarriage, rather than being a threat, is actually the issue that is revealing an important question to take on, which is fundamentally, what is or should Judaism be? And that certainly does not seem to have been at all the lens through which the larger Jewish establishment has looked at the question, right? To say, does the fact that actually intermarriage, you know, we might be seeing results from intermarried families that surprise us in certain ways, does that perhaps open us to the question of whether maybe our definitions were wrong?
Right. And, you know, I guess I would do that like academic thing and just tweak your vocabulary a little with that, which
yeah,
is that
do.
I wouldn't say wrong. I would say it's just changing. There have been lots of times when the definition of Judaism or being Jewish has had to change, right? Could Judaism survive galut, right? Could it survive exile? You know, there were lots of reasons to believe absolutely not, because Judaism was about being in a particular place, right? You know, there are lots of ways that there were places that Jews went or forces that they encountered, right? Could Judaism survive living under the kingship of some other religious group or ethno-national group? Absolutely not. And then that definition has to change, right? I mean, in a sense, Judaism has died many, many deaths as the way that it was sort of dominantly defined had to be jettisoned. Clearly, living in a moment when that work might have to happen is uncomfortable at best, and I think crisis-inducing, you know, in many ways. And so, I do think that that's the problem with intermarriage, right? Because it demands that that definition of Judaism be changed. Not that we say it was necessarily wrong. You know, I don't know that there's need for recrimination, but there's certainly need, and it's not even need. It's not like somebody is saying, you know, this needs to happen. It almost is just what is happening, right? When you have reconfigurations of the group, those old definitions are not going to make sense. You know, people at various times wondered if Jews could live outside of cities, right? If Jews could occupy all sorts of different positions, and, you know, what would it mean to talk about Jews in very different social positions?
So I think that's a great clarification. And I guess there are two things on my mind, right? One is that when people are expressing this concern that Judaism is dying in whatever way, right, the question becomes, and I think the question that we should put to them and that we should all just be thinking about is, like, when we're worried that Judaism is dying, which Judaism are we worried that's dying, right? And I think that a lot of the existential anxiety comes from the imagination that the Judaism that's been around for 2,000 or 3,000 years is dying, as opposed to the Judaism that was invented in 1950 is dying, right? And is it fair to talk about Judaism, sort of post-war Judaism, as some form of a bubble where actually Judaism sort of expanded and became something because of a certain set of circumstances that maybe people imagined was going to be the permanent situation, but it turned out it was actually a short-term situation, including the fact that there was endogamy, but also the fact that Jews were living in the suburbs, and also the fact that the economy was a certain way, and also the fact that the Holocaust only had so much power to have a certain impact, et cetera, et cetera. And that, in a way, what we might be experiencing is less a dying of Judaism and more perhaps some kind of a right-sizing that says, let's go back to some trend that was actually happening maybe ever since the Enlightenment, and that actually the last 50 years may have actually been the blip as opposed to the thing that we're trying to prevent from dying.
It's something I've been thinking about a lot. There's a book that came out by a U.S. historian named Jeff Cowie, and the book is called The Great Exception. And it is making the argument that the period after the New Deal and into the Great Society, so the period, you know, starting in the 1930s, but then into the 1960s, 1970s, was a great exception in American life. And that a kind of constellation of factors having to do with politics and economics, the, you know, trends in demography meant that liberalism looked a certain way during that time period, and that, you know, people who grew up during that time period and people who have kind of inherited the notion that that was like true American liberalism aren't able to see that this is totally exceptional. The way that the inequality gap had maybe started to close during that time period, the way that the government was involved in providing for public services and becoming more of an interventionist state or a social welfare state, that this wasn't like setting a trend of what would always be, but this was just extraordinarily exceptional for various reasons. And in fact, the patterns that we're now encountering where the inequality gap has really grown hugely, where the state is retrenching itself in various ways, where there's more privatization, people talk about a kind of new Gilded Age, that this is sort of returning to what actually was. And I actually think there are a lot of problems with that thesis that we could talk about another time. But the one reason having to do with American Jews and American Judaism that I've been preoccupied with it is because, like, this is specifically that period that all American Jewish history sort of, it's the crescendo of it. It accounts for a kind of triumphalism in the historical writing about American Jews. And I think in the, you know, more community-based sort of folk history that American Jews tell themselves. I don't know, I don't know about the right-sizing piece, and there's something, I guess, Dan, in your question that feels reactionary. I'm not saying that you're necessarily reactionary, but that sort of notion that we're going to go back to some period before this kind of exceptional bubble of post-war Judaism.
It's less that I'm wondering whether there were actually important questions being asked at that time and important forces going on that we could go back to because they're actually suddenly relevant in a way that we didn't realize that they ever would be again. And that so it's less about going back to the glory days and more wondering whether there were things going on there that had actually been going on for like 100 years or something like that, that got cut off by this sort of, you know, aberrant state, right? And that we actually might value in a new way.
Well, I certainly think that conversations about Zionism from the 1930s have now gained a new kind of vitality. So there's more historical scholarship tracing the sort of flexibility that existed in Zionist thinking, in non-Zionist thinking, in real vigorous debate about what it would mean for Jews to define themselves via a nation state. And that those discussions and debates were really live and were not the cause for defining who was inside or outside the group, right? So one could very much be identified as being Jewish, as being part of the Jewish community, as caring about the future of that community, and very vigorously and vociferously reject the idea of the nation state-based Zionism, you know, at the end of the 19th century and into the beginning of the 20th century. So there are, you know, as I think the policies in the state of Israel, the government of the state of Israel has pursued certain ways of acting toward Palestinians, certain ways of using its power that, you know, people are questioning, what does this mean for Jewish life to be defining itself according to the policies of this particular government, for example? There is an effort to look back to some of those conversations and say that the kind of fervent American Zionism that really characterized post-war American Judaism maybe made some sense for that time, but maybe it's not what is going to be enduring in this time.
So I have a question that at first I was going to say was like a shift to a new topic, but I actually think I'm suspicious that it is actually related, which is, you've written a great deal lately about the issue of funding in Jewish life. And at first that feels very different, but as I think about it, one part that you spoke about and that we actually mentioned some of your pieces at the time was this issue of whether and to what extent Jewish institutions, due to their funding mechanisms, can sort of be political or speak out on political questions. And the reason I think that it actually might be related, and once again, you can tell me if this inclination feels right or not, is that what we've been talking about is sort of a shift away from, or a shift into language of Jewishness that is about sort of collective identity, about communities, about peoples, about sociological identifiers, and not necessarily about like values. And when organization after organization is talking about how we need to not be about particular political values, we need to be apolitical for X, Y, and Z reason, I'm curious if that relates to that shift. Because when I look to literature about, you know, the late 19th century, when Jews were trying actively to be conceived of as a religion, it seems like beliefs and values were very much part of that conversation, including in public fora. And like, I'm curious just to talk about like what are some of the issues in Jewish institutional funding today, especially in the realm of politics that you've written about, and do they, or to what extent do they relate to these earlier conversations we've been having on this episode?
Yes, I think it's absolutely related. And I think that the sort of move to claim a part of space, a neutral space, a depoliticized space for Jewish life is really connected to that kind of social scientific language, right? That and even to, you know, the language of community, of peoplehood, you know, that this is not something that is explicitly defined as being about politics, right? It's defined as a space that, you know, one is born into. It has to do with, you know, sort of where you live and the people you affiliate with, who you feel close to. And I think that part of kind of what happened in that post-war period in American Judaism is that, you know, some of the more radical edges of Jewish politics that had at various points, you know, really come quite close to the center of defining what American Jewish life might be, those are sort of stripped away for various reasons, in part because of pressures of the American state, and in part because new openings, right? That, you know, one didn't have to kind of call for some kind of revolution if the state itself was saying, we'll let you be who you want to be in this state, and we'll subsidize some of who you want to be. We'll give you tax exemptions, and we'll help you pay your mortgage, and, you know, we'll make things okay for you, right? So you don't need to define yourself politically because the state will do that work for you, and it can be sort of invisible in a certain way. And, you know, never mind that it's not doing that work for certain other groups of people. And I think we see the traces of that, the enduring power of that, in the way that Jewish institutions today continue to talk about themselves as being apolitical. And, you know, a little bit of what I have written, and this was inspired by the election of Trump and then different Jewish institutions' reactions, well, you know, we're not going to take sides on this, was my effort to say, well, look, you are political. Like, this stuff that you've been saying is not political is extraordinarily political. For example, if you're a Jewish federation, upwards of 80% of your agency grants come from the federal government. So you have a vested interest in the government doing certain things, of power flowing in certain directions. That is political. If you are a synagogue, you take a tax exemption, meaning that the government is subsidizing, that public tax dollars are subsidizing what you do and in part regulating and defining what you can and can't do. That is political. So, you know, there's sometimes a sort of slippage. Well, what we really mean is that we don't want to be partisan. And, you know, I think the whole language of being partisan is right now one of the most violent languages in American life. And it is, I fear, an incredibly sort of regulating language, and a language that is going to, is doing violence right now to the ability to think about what justice is. But that effort to claim that Jewish institutions, and it's not just Jewish institutions, lots of different institutions of American life are not political, and that lends them more credibility or more legitimacy, is not only a big lie, but it's a silencing technique. And I, you know, don't think that I saw it entirely for what it was until the, you know, post-election period, when it was so often the dodge that was being used, especially by organizations that actually have incredible power in the form of capital, in the form of access to elected leaders, and were not using it. It just strikes me as completely disingenuous to claim that there isn't something political going on. It doesn't mean that one has to say, I'm going to campaign for this person or that person. But I think it means that these institutions cannot pretend that they are aloof from the political world in which we're living.
I'm trying very hard to reject the frame of politics as applied to Trump, in the sense that, for me, Trump is the example of, from a values standpoint, everything that Judaism has taught throughout its history to be concerned about and to be wary of, ranging from just the characteristics themselves, the behaviors themselves, to some of the characters in our literature, kings of various kinds, that are really out there as the cautionary tale. These are the bad kinds of kings, right? And when you see a person running our country and exhibiting a certain set of behaviors that are so clearly contrary to the Jewish tradition, sort of broadly defined, and you're not able to say so, or a rabbi isn't able to say so for fear of being tarred as engaging in politics or partisan politics. Yes, it has a political effect, even a partisan effect, if you were to say these things. But if you were not to say these things, it would seem to be that you are leaving aside a whole realm of Jewish values from which you can't really talk and teach from anymore, because they so clearly apply in a certain way politically. And what are you supposed to do, right? And why shouldn't I be able to find a way to say that as a Jewish thinker, whether I'm a professional Jewish thinker or just a regular Jewish thinker, without somehow being accused of sort of bringing some kind of unpleasant politics into a space that's supposed to be more, I don't know, contemplative and meditational, or whatever people want to talk about that way?
The notion that politics should somehow be separate from religious spaces or polite community spaces, you know, is probably one of the pieces of that post-war American moment that I think is going to crumble. And I think one way that we actually will see it crumble, and there's certainly irony to this, is with the end of the sway of the Johnson Amendment, right? So the Johnson Amendment was basically, you know, this sort of piece of that becomes part of tax code that religious institutions and nonprofit institutions should not be allowed to involve themselves in partisan matters, right? And Trump himself has said, I want to get rid of this because I want religious institutions to be able to talk politics as much as they want. Now, obviously, he has his particular reasons for wanting to do that and different constituent groups that he wants to please. And then, you know, the kind of liberal response is that this would be horrible, right? That there's no space for politics and religion, and this would, you know, just be awful. You'd have this, you know, massive evangelical movement telling their congregants who to vote for. And the whole thing is a charade because, first of all, If you read the history of the rise of the evangelical movement in the United States, it's a completely political kind of history. And it is explicitly about these different political leaders making it very clear to their congregants what kind of political work has to happen to create an environment in which this vision of evangelical Christianity can thrive. So there's already the kind of political work being done in religious space. Revoking the Johnson Amendment is not going to change that. What it is going to do is tell liberal folks, you've got to come and speak your politics and speak your power much more clearly. And I think about a piece, a column that Jane Eisner wrote in the foreword, where she really puts forward the very spirited liberal defense that I don't want to walk into my synagogue and hear about politics. And, you know, my answer is like, A, you already are. And B, what world do you live in that you think is going to be served by that? And if what you're saying is, well, you know, it's going to keep Judaism sort of hermetically sealed off from that messiness of politics and really, you know, nervous about the fragility of Judaism. And if our communities start fighting about politics, then oy, what's going to happen? You know, I think forget the whole project then, right? I mean, if Judaism is so fragile that it can't handle that work, it can't handle our spiritual leaders taking strong moral positions that have politics, that have economic visions, then forget it, right? Then it's lost already. I happen to think that it is so strong because there have been spiritual leaders and engaged, active people who are talking about their Judaism as being something that is political, that demands a kind of political force to it. And, you know, we have seen this throughout Jewish history. Right? These are, in fact, some of the voices that we hold most tightly to.
Look, I understand the person who wants to come to synagogue and have a politics-free zone. I'm not interested in that Judaism. So on the one hand, if I respect that there are people who feel that way, I look at that and I say, well, maybe we're not part of the same endeavor. And it connects to perhaps a contradiction, right? Because in certain ways, I've been thinking about this, that Abraham Joshua Heschel's marching with Martin Luther King was in a certain way the greatest, most powerful and effective, and I'm just talking about impact, not quality, right? But a teaching moment in the history of American Judaism, right? That to teach Jews what Judaism was about, to teach non-Jews what Judaism was about. And a lot of folks didn't agree with that, right? A lot of folks didn't agree that Heschel was teaching the right thing. And so I wonder if, on the one hand, we hold that moment up as sort of the defining educational and maybe language moment of a certain vision of what American Judaism is, then we also kind of see the white space where there is another version of American Judaism that doesn't see that as its most basic and essential definition. And is that where we are? You know, are we talking past each other because we actually have two profoundly different notions of what the project even is?
Right. I mean, if it were just two, I think that would be that would be an achievement. You know, I think that one response to a time like the one that we're living in today is retreat, right? You know, wanting to again, you know, go into the sanctuary and find that place where you don't have to deal with any of it. And I get that. But I think when institutions, in a sense, take as their mission this notion that they're going to be able to sort of rise above the fray, and that will be what enables, you know, Judaism, Jewishness to sort of move on and to survive, it's just completely misguided. So I don't know that it's like two Judaisms per se. I think it's really that there are these pockets of incredible power and money that are in this space, defined by that kind of post-war depoliticization, by this sort of notion of consensus as a value, you know, that don't really know yet how to take other kinds of leadership.
I want to play with Heschel a little more, because when Dan asked that question, I think that Heschel's actions and Heschel's idea that my legs were praying at Selma, you know, the famous quote, I think that it has been in some circles, like Dan said, the best teaching moment ever in American Jewish history. I think that's it's been used to channel people towards the idea that to be a mensch, to be a good Jew, is to stand up in instances of oppression and injustice and do better. I actually think, though, that in a lot of circles, it's been used for a terrible teaching moment, which is it's sort of the difference between descriptive and prescriptive thinking. What the prescriptive takeaway from this is, Jews should go and stand for justice. The descriptive thing is, look. Heschel and all sorts of Jews did all sorts of wonderful things during the civil rights movement. We are great. I was given that message in certain educational contexts, and I've seen it in many other educational contexts. And more than that, I actually, with a friend of mine, I wrote a piece when the movie Selma came out, because everybody was crying about how, oh my gosh, like Heschel wasn't centralized in this movie. If that's your takeaway from Selma, from beatings on the Pettus Bridge, I'm really struggling, sort of like what I think each of you has indicated, like to consider myself part of the same project. Like, I want this project to, on some level, be saying, oh, what Heschel did is an example for us to follow, not something we can point to and say, we sort of checked that box, we're set.
You know, it's interesting, when I would go and talk to different groups about my research on Detroit and about Jews leaving cities after World War II, I realized that, especially for people who had lived that narrative, whether it was Detroit or another city where they had made decisions to leave cities at a time when the federal government was disinvesting from cities, at a time when, you know, African Americans were moving into new geographical spaces of the city, there was a kind of assumption that what I was telling them is that they should feel guilty and that they should feel shame. And so I think some of what you're describing is, you know, from a generation that feels castigated, that feels blamed for not solving some of the problems of racial inequality, of economic injustice in our country. And what I always try to say to people when they get their backs up, when I'm, you know, sort of presenting my research about white flight and Jews' involvement in shifts in racial politics, is to think about structures, right? That this is not a burden that you as an individual should feel like you have to carry, right? So you shouldn't have to feel like you have to say, look, like, enough already. Remember, Heschel did this. We were really doing the right thing. Like, stop bugging me. You should instead be able to understand that there were all these different structures and patterns that came from years and years of history of where economic resources flowed, of how the American state worked and served certain populations and didn't serve other populations, of the kind of capital that had been created off the backs of slavery, and then post-slavery systems that still depended on the same kind of racial logic. So that you don't feel like you're being blamed for, you know, historical injustices, but so instead you can feel like you have the tools and the ability to understand these structures and then to think about, how do we resist some of them? How do we change some of them? That's a lot of the kind of educative work that needs to happen.
Are there any other key issues that you wanted to explore while we're talking about all these important questions?
Well, I guess my hobby horse lately has been thinking about endowment. You know, we've talked a lot about Jewish institutions, and I'm writing a book about philanthropy and thinking about specifically the kind of capital practices, the financial practices of Jewish philanthropic institutions. And I guess if there's something from the kind of archives and from history that I would like to, you know, I don't know on the face of it how exciting it would be to the average Jew, but I'd like to be able to explain to the world, is that these kinds of practices of holding on to money in institutions and valuing the success of an institution by its ability to sort of amass endowment and to sort of have a lot of money on hand that's held, this is really a relatively new phenomenon in Jewish institutional life. But when we talk about Jewish institutions being sort of fixated on consensus and defining themselves as what I would say is not apolitical, but depoliticized, I think it's actually tied into those capital practices, right? Sort of believing that, A, that money that is held somehow dictates that the institution has to act for the community in a particular kind of consensus-based way, and B, that that institution will not be able to continue having access to resources and to being able to hold capital unless it speaks in this sort of consensus way. And that without that capital, without sort of that money that's just held, that these institutions can't imagine their perpetuity and therefore can't imagine the sort of survival of the Judaism and Jewishness that they know. And it's maybe a stretch, but I actually think that you got to change the capital practices, the financial practices. And this is why I've become so interested in philanthropy, because I think through these financial practices, there are different sorts of intersections happening both with a kind of American political economy, but also with really defining the values and value of Judaism. We need to think about how we've arrived at this moment where there are these ways of circulating only a very, very small percentage of wealth held. Why is it that that's what we do now? And why is it that we're so certain that that's the only way that Jewish life will survive, right? That, you know, it's certainly in the self-interest of these institutions to imagine that they can exist in perpetuity. But is it in the interest of the Jewish communities who these institutions claim to be serving? And I guess I would finish this thought by saying that I think one thing that the Trump era has made us or will make us face is the fact that if the state is not granting to social welfare organizations and is not playing the kind of activist role that it did for so long in the post-war period, all of these resources that are kind of sitting in these endowment funds may have to be released. And so forgetting my critique, there just may be, you know, kind of clear and present need for it. And so maybe we can get ahead of it a little bit and think about, you know, what are other ways for circulating resources and letting capital flow, and with it, letting go of this sort of mandate of consensus and this mandate of being depolitical.
Thank you so much for bringing that note into this conversation. It's not something that was at the front of my mind, but I think it's a really important issue for us to continue to think about in our future episodes. But just in general, thank you so much for joining us for this conversation. It's been a fascinating one, and we covered a lot of ground. I feel like I am going to take a few solid moments to internalize it all, but this is really wonderful and a great service to our listeners.
Thank you so much. You guys are phenomenal question askers. So I really appreciated the ability to think through my work through the lens of your intellectual curiosity and your knowledge. So thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to this episode of Judaism Unbound featuring guest Lila Corwin Berman. And we want to close it out in the same way we always do, by encouraging you to be in touch with us. And there are a few ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can check out our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can always hit us up via email at dan@nextjewishfuture.org or lex@nextjewishfuture.org. The last plug we like to make is that you can always support us financially with a donation of any amount, either a one-time gift or a monthly recurring donation, and you can do that at judaismunbound.com/donate. So thanks so much for listening, and with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.